What's up, everybody? This is Raleigh Williams. We got Mubarak Shaw here, who is the M&A accountant guru. So we are going to talk about a business that I bought at the end of last year, at the end of 2020. So just recently, we're recording this on January 9th. And I thought it'd be cool if me and Mubarak kind of jammed on it for a little bit instead of me just going by myself on it. And so that is what we're going to talk about today.
Awesome. Awesome. And, you know, I would say most people watching this are probably trying to do their first acquisition, right? So they might not have the background that you do, that I do, that we've kind of seen this playbook multiple times, but kind of give us the vision from the beginning. Like, okay, first deal, did you buy 100%? Did you buy partial? What are the initial things that go into your head when you even located the deal?
So my initial contact with the seller of this business was, she hit me up on Facebook. She was actually referred to me by somebody that followed me on LinkedIn. I was posting content about how to make your business sellable. And she reached out to me and said, hey, I'm thinking about selling my business. And I just want to know what that process looks like. I think when a lot of people hear that, they feel like that's not replicable, that it's not something that they can really do. And I think one of the important things is just social media is such an important tool and it's becoming more and more important as time goes on. Unfortunately, I hate posting on my social media.
And why is that? Because I'm sure a lot of people can relate, right? Talk about why that is. Do you feel like...
I was a mergers and acquisitions lawyer in 2016. I was running a business. I ran a business for 5 years that I sold. For the first 5 years of leaving law, I felt like it was braggy. I always wanted to get press and attention just by being like really good at what I do. That was always like the
heads down operator.
Yeah, just like news outlets, just like, whoa, you're growing something that's awesome. Like, we want you on the news. Yeah. And two things happened that helped me change my mind. One, the first time I ever posted on social media, as like, this is my thought, this is how I think about things, was when there was a lawyer in California that committed suicide. He was a partner, he was 42 years old, partner at Sidley Austin in California, which is a big law firm, a prestigious law firm. And he had killed himself in the parking lot of his law firm garage. I didn't know the guy, but for whatever reason, that story was like, I figured out a way out of this thing and I need to at least share something about there's a way to get out if you want to get out. So back in 2019, I was still operating the trampoline park and escape room business. But for whatever reason, that story hit me as I could really have seen myself being that guy, not knowing how to get out of this thing that I was in and practicing law. And I was miserable practicing law. And I felt like I needed to tell the story a little bit more than I had, which was really scary for me because I always felt like if my business failed, I always wanted to keep the bridge available to like, and when you start talking
That's your fallback.
Yeah, you start talking shit about like, yo, big law firms suck. And like, you can get out if you want to, which is really how I felt about things, but I didn't feel comfortable putting it out there. But anyway, that story helped. So that was the first big thing. And over the past probably 18 months, 2 years, I was paying attention to Warren Buffett, who's the OG of all of it. And Warren Buffett took speech classes from Dale Carnegie on like how to be a persuasive public speaker. Yep. On all of the newspapers that he bought. He published his deal criteria for Berkshire Hathaway of we're looking for these type of businesses. And he also does like the annual shareholders letter, which would be like the equivalent of our social media today. Like Buffett and Munger spent a lot of time getting their message out there, getting Berkshire's message out there. Buffett does a ton of press, PR. I think for me, it always felt cringeworthy. Like even today, even if you saw a post that I did on January 9th, as I posted it today, it feels cringeworthy to me. It still feels uncomfortable. I hate doing it.
But it leads to inbound. It leads to the magical inbound that everyone wants.
It's become a necessary evil. It's become less and less burdensome, less and less painful over time. It led to this inbound deal. It's my little 2 cents on posting, even though you feel stupid about it.
But that's key. So that's key because here's the thing, like that found the deal that was successful. And I'll have you talk about what the deal is and the result in a second, but kind of hone in on that because you know, people spend years, searchers spend years of their life, have six-figure, seven-figure opportunity costs, not being able to find a deal. Just give just a quick 30 seconds on, like, first of all, what were you posting? What type of content? Why did that person feel comfortable reaching out to you? Was it the way your LinkedIn was set up, your Twitter was set up? Was it the type of content you were putting out there? What drew them to feel comfortable to DM you, you know, that, hey, I have a deal?
So I think there was a period of time that I was really posting about when I sold my businesses. I moved my message from lawyers getting out of law to entrepreneurs getting out of their business. And so how do you exit something? And so for a period of time, that was kind of all I was posting about. How do you make your business sellable? You should build it to sell it. A guy that I never talked to, his name's, well, I won't say his name, but I've never talked to him before. He just follows me and he's a financial planner. And he just read some of my content on exits, which I hadn't really done in a while. I've kind of moved on more and more to kind of just general startup stuff now. And so I think I'm almost hesitant to say like that there was a magic elixir in the stuff that I was posting about, because I think even that holds people back from
posting. Putting yourself out there. You're at least posting something. You're at least getting.
I think anyone who's watching this should go on to the platform that they're the most comfortable, whether it's an Instagram Live or a Twitter, and say, yo, this is me posting, and post it. And like that can be the first post, just getting it done. And then over time, you'll get closer and closer to the message and the voice that you want to talk about. And that's iterative. That's an iterative process that takes years, that at least I haven't been able to map that out on a whiteboard and be like, this is it from here on out. It changes over time.
You're still making it work. You know, it's like done is better than perfect. You're just putting it out there and everything. Okay. Okay. All right. Now let's get to the fun part. Tell us about the deal.
The deal. So she reached out to me and she said, hey, I got your info from this guy and I'd love to hop on a call and talk about what I could potentially do to sell my business. So I sent her a Calendly link and I had an hour call with her. I was looking at her business. At high level, it teaches people in the medical profession how to start side hustles that uses their licensing in order to do the side hustle. So this isn't the business, but it's basically if a doctor wanted to pay money to learn how to be a sports medicine doctor for high school kids and make money on the side outside of being in the hospital type deal.
So maybe like a CPA that's in audit doing a tax practice on the side, something like that.
Yep. So it's just using the education, but in the healthcare space. So using the education and the certifications on this highly educated subsegment in the medical field, how they can leave the grind in the 9-to-5 of the job that they signed up for using the licensing and the certifications that they already have. So we had this hour call and she had a very personality driven brand. She posts a lot. She's a very public figure. And so my recommendation to her was, you need to build systems and processes and show a potential seller what it would be like to own the business without you pushing it all of the time. You know, you need to show that a buyer can buy this business and it won't crumble to the ground without you being involved with it. And so I looked at her business. I saw everything. It was doing a little north of $300,000 a year in revenue. She felt like she was doing something around $150,000 a year in profit, and really as dove into the numbers later, she was making more than she thought that she did with ad backs and expense things that she was running through her personal life through the business. And when I saw the business, I was like, the thing that this business really needs is something that I can't really help with, which is this business is sold through webinars. It's sold through online kind of direct sales marketing. I looked at the business as something I had to help her as much as I could, but I didn't look at it as an acquirer. I was just like, you should do these things and work on it as you go.
And just doing advice out, kind of. You analyze the deal, but not from like a buyer's approach. You were just looking at it to kind of figure out how to help, or?
I was really looking at it as a seller's approach. Like if I were in your shoes, this is what I would do to improve the value of this business. She actually joined Deal Trends and she was in that group and she was talking to buyers and she was just kind of in there working on this 3-to-6-month plan on how to have this business improve over time. And
you said a lot there though, in the initial thing. One thing I want to go into is because I think a ton of founders are in this position, which is how do you recommend people pull themselves out of their business? We hear it all the time where it's like, you're working in the business, not on the business. How does that actually end up happening? Or how do you see that? What advice would you give there?
I think for a lot of founders, this wasn't the case with her, but for a lot of founders, the profit and loss statement has to tell the story that you're telling the buyer when you're talking to them. So she was telling me this business runs itself, but she didn't have employees and systems in place that there were costs associated with. So like, you can't say this business runs itself and also the labor is free because I run everything, yeah, right? Yeah. And so you have to start putting in places the things, just like whenever you're going through the process of figuring out what products to sell and you're trying to think about who my avatar is, what my customer really wants. She spent a lot of time thinking about what these medical professionals wanted in their business. Your new customer is the acquirer of the business. And what do they want to see? All acquirers, they don't want businesses, they want assets. And assets run themselves. And so you have to show that this thing runs itself. And the profit and loss statement has to have all of the boxes checked on the fact that it runs itself. So there's somebody that's taking the inbound calls, there's an onboarding procedure, and it all just has to make sense and has to flow. And so for her, she was saying this business runs itself, but then when you go onto the landing page of the business, it's her face all there, right?
Yeah.
Hey, my name is XYZ and I've done this great thing and I can help you do it too.
And it makes it harder for someone to want to buy it because, you know, that other person has branded themselves in the company. So it's like, sometimes it's like these professional services where, hey, do they want the firm or do they want the individual? So it's
right. Okay. Yeah, that's like a lot of construction businesses where the owner operator is the heart of the business. And when you pull that out, all you have is a corpse, and corpses have value to certain people. But most of those people want to sell a live organism, but they're the heart of everything. And so you have to re-engineer the fact that this business operates as an asset to me. And it makes it work. So when I was selling my businesses, I made sure that every potential acquirer knew that I didn't even live in the same state as the business, right? I lived in Texas and I was selling businesses in Utah, right? That shows.
You attract a massive audience of potential buyers because you can be absentee. It's more passive. Right. You know, they don't have to be putting in 70-hour.
Right.
Okay.
And you also have to expect that a potential acquirer is going to secret shop it. So if I'm saying, listen, I live in Texas, I don't do anything in this thing, this thing runs itself. And then they call the cell phone of the store and it's, hey, this is Raleigh Williams. Welcome to Alcatraz Escape Game, right? It's a massive disconnect. All trust is gone. That the story that you're telling a potential acquirer doesn't check out with very light due diligence. And so for her, it was a process of starting to extract herself. And as she was doing that, I met a guy who wanted to start buying businesses. And we were talking about buying businesses. He's got great experience in webinars. I mean, it's what he does. He's a webinar guy. That's like his MO, is he can help people scale their business with webinars. I had my first conversation with her in July of 2022. I was talking to him in November of 2022. So 4 or 5 months had passed. And I said to him, let's just use this as a use case. Let's look at this business that I know the numbers on and let's just tear it apart. It's too small. It doesn't work. She doesn't know what she's doing. The webinar is too far off. This is too much work or it's too expensive. Let's just use this as a use case. So that way we're not talking in hypotheticals about the type of businesses that we could potentially go buy. And so we pulled up the P&L and we pulled up the balance sheet. And I said, what do you think about this? And the conversation was basically, this seems great. Tell me about the founder. I'm like, oh, the founder's amazing.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So you start off with the website, you did some initial due diligence, you know, you checked out the company overall website, you saw that. Then you asked for the financials. Is that where you start, P&L balance sheet? Is that where you start? And then what made the P&L and balance sheet great? Like, what should we look for? What do you recommend for people analyzing businesses? What stood out for you?
I think the thing that made the P&L great from our standpoint was we looked at the website and we said, okay, there's a lot of easy fixes that can be had here, right? There's a lot of things that we know that we can improve to add value in. So that's just one thing. Then we go and look at the P&L in tandem with that. And we say, wow, this thing is actually pretty profitable despite not being massively optimized, right? This thing is pretty successful and there's a lot of easy changes that are within our circle of competence to fix that it would be crazy if it didn't improve the value of the business from where it stands today. And the big thing,
you're not necessarily looking for an incredible business. You want to be able to find a business that you can see obvious improvements that you can bring in yourself. So maybe you immediately know that you can change the entire growth curve of the business because you can make these improvements the second you acquire it or so. Is that
Yeah. And within this partnership that I have with this guy that runs these webinars, that's right. We're looking for underutilized, undervalue with improvements in a different scenario, in a different setting with limited partners and a fund setting where it's like, give me the wonderful business. You know, it's better to buy a wonderful business at a fair price than a fair business at a wonderful price. I understand that playbook. I like that playbook. But in this scenario with this guy who's going through his first acquisition, we were self-funding it. We brought a little bit of other people's money in, but we wanted to make sure that the deal was small enough that we didn't have to take outside debt. You know, we weren't looking for SBA financing. We were looking for a side project that we could co-invest in together and build with the skill sets that we have. And so for us, it was, let's find something underutilized, undervalued, and take it down that way.
Got it. Okay. So technically though, would you say that people making their first acquisition, their first deal, that's kind of what they should probably look for, right? Not talking about the corp dev world and the 100 million plus companies, right? But talking about anything under less than 5 million, 10 million, you want to be opportunistic, right? You want to be able to make those changes.
If you're looking for the business that is going to fund your lifestyle, you want that to be the highest quality asset that you can afford, right? Okay. You know, the bigger the deal, the less risky it is typically. And so you want something that...
That's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? The bigger the deal, the less risky it is, you said.
Totally.
Why is that? That's an interesting point. I feel like it's because you can probably hire some... You have more room to hire people then, right? Is that...
Yeah, I think you have more room to hire people. It's more proven on the growth curve of the business. There's a big gap that we bought this business, I call it 200 grand trailing 12 months seller discretionary earnings. And we are going to have to go from 200 to a million, and then everything's going to break at a million, right? And we're going to have to rebuild it and try to get it to 3 million and everything's going to break again. And so when you're buying something, whatever the cap is for the SBA, if you're buying a $5 million asset that's kicking off 1.25 million in seller discretionary earnings, right? They've gone through the breaking and rebuilding process a couple of times. And so you're buying something that's more substantial. I mean, obviously we're painting with broad strokes. You're doing something that's safer versus on the other end, this past week, I bought a website for $4,000, right? That has 1,200 users that are all free. And if six people go on the site at the same time, it breaks down. It's like a piece of junk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I bought something that's duct tape and paper clipped together. It's too small. I think of the business world as the ocean. And, you know, we basically signed on to work on a raft, a wooden raft that's kind of lassoed together with twine. They're like, we can handle some waves, but we're going to try to get it to a canoe and then like a fishing boat and then the smallest size yacht that exists. And that's probably where the thing will max out at, to the extent that you could start at the yacht and you get choppy seas and everything else. Like you can weather those storms on the yacht than you can. Like the 4,000 thing that I bought is basically like a partially deflated floating toy from Walmart. You know what I mean? I've tried to blow up as like waves are crashing in, particularly if you're a searcher or you're somebody that is looking to leave the opportunity that you're in order to fully focus on the business that you're acquiring. You want the bigger, the better. Or if you're looking to do multiple deals, right? And you don't need to insert yourself into the org chart of the business.
You don't need to become the operator, the CEO.
And those are bigger deals. We were both looking for something that could do on the side and kind of prove the model of that we can improve these type of assets that are creator-led, solopreneur businesses. You know, we think that there's a model that exists out there that we can be the capital partner for those businesses and a strategic partner to take them from $1 million a year to $10 million a year plus. And there's no one else that's really playing that game. That's where we see it going long-term, but that's why we did it at that size.
Makes sense. Okay, so let's go back to the deal process. So you did the initial due diligence, you got the balance sheet, the P&L, you and your partner looked at it, you signed off. How does the conversation go? What's the next step in the process?
The next step in the process is I reached out to the seller and I said, I've known of this business for a couple months now. Where are you at in the process? And she had been trying to sell. She had a couple interested parties that had kind of backed out on her. So we were lucky in the sense that when she initially listed the business, she was massively optimistic. I'm going to make a ton of money. I'm going to sell this thing. I'm going to be able to move on to my next thing. Right. Yeah. 4 or 5 months into the sales process, and you've talked to 7 buyers and they've all shown interest and then bailed. You start getting to the point where you're like, I want to do something. I need to do something. I need to figure this out. And so it was fortuitous timing in that standpoint. And I just asked her where she was at in the sales process. It became apparent to us that this business was worth nothing without her involved. And so I asked her what her tolerance would be, if she would be open to selling a portion of the business instead of all of the business, and how much equity could we buy to make her still massively incentivized. So I just asked her conceptually, if I brought in the perfect partner that could really help you scale this thing, the perfect skill set, would you be open to staying on and running this thing? She had gotten to the point where she was trying to build the P&L story that this thing could run without her. And so she initially had excitement that she could focus on other things, focus on a newsletter, and kind of let this thing manage itself, but she had missed it. She wanted to get back in and talk to these people that she enjoyed. So like the grass is greener thing had also kind of worn off on her, right? Where she started to focus on other things. Focusing on a new thing is hard anyway. And so she wanted to go back into it anyway. And so when I asked her if she would be open to sell a portion of it, that she could take some cash off of the table, keep some cash in the business and grow it together with me and somebody else, if she was open to it, she was like, that would be amazing. That sounds perfect. That sounds like exactly what I would want to do, because I miss working on this business. I think this business could be awesome. And the more that I've thought about selling it to somebody else, the more I'm like, this is my baby and I really want to work on it. And she was at a point that she was stuck at the level that she was at, and she didn't know how to get to the next level. So she's like, I'll sell it and I'll go back to zero again and build something back up to the level that this business was. And so that was in the end of November.
Okay.
When I had met with my partner, I said, oh, this business could actually work. Let me reach out to her and see if she's open to the concept. She said that she was open to the concept. And I submitted an LOI to her and said, we would transact on these terms. We want to buy 2/3 of the business. We want you to take 6 figures. We want to give you 6 figures off of the table.
Did you already know what price you wanted to sell it at? When she reached out to you, did she say, hey, I want to sell it at this amount? Or how did you guys come up with the number that she wanted? What is something she proposed, you proposed, or how would you recommend first-time buyers, first-time acquisition entrepreneurs do going about that process?
So when she reached out to me the first time, she said, I want to give this business away. Should I do that?
Oh, interesting. Okay. So she had it. She was like ready to. But she reached out to you a few months later in the process, right? I think that's
out to her.
Okay. And that, I think that's really interesting, because that's what I've seen a lot, is that I think a lot of people get paralyzed or fear they might not reach out because of the price tag, or because it seems intimidating. But like you talked about, a seller might think they're going to get $1 million for the business, but they, a lot of times sellers overvalue the business. They don't understand the real multiple of it.
Yeah.
They don't understand the industry multiple. They don't understand the macroeconomic trends. And so when their business might only be fair market value of 200K or so, they think it's $1 million. But then, like you said, over time, what happens is the people reach out, they get lowball offers, they don't get the interest they need, just like in real estate, where if you list your house way too high, you can think whatever you want, but there is a market. And I think the problem with the business world is that unless you have like a CPA or valuation expert, like there's no Zillow out there, right? There's like rough industry multiples and stuff that help. But most sellers I've found, at least, especially unsophisticated sellers, meaning like literally anyone under 10 million, which is already a large amount.
Yeah.
Most of us in America are smaller than that, and they don't get that valuation. So, you know, I just wanted to highlight that to anyone listening, that the sellers, right, their motivations will constantly change. And so it's up to you, if you want to buy your first deal, if you have to always be top of mind for them. You know, that means checking in every couple of weeks, every couple of months, having some type of feeler out there. Because just as you mentioned already, your seller thought she was going to get a crazy amount, an awesome amount, retire or something like that, probably dropped it a lot, then started missing the business, then reached out to you to take the business.
Yeah.
Just like we all have the fluctuations.
It's a massive emotional process. Obviously, if you're dealing with a broker, there's some third party there. They try to band that wave as much as they can. But obviously they want a transaction too. You know, they're usually incentivized to just have something trade as quickly as possible when they have a listing that's interesting.
So she's got back into the number that you put into the LOI. Talk about
how did I back into it?
Yeah. Because the LOI letter of intent says, hey, I will buy this business based on due diligence at these metrics, right? You know, there are different formats, different templates, but you generally have to put some multiple or some purchase price, right?
Yeah. So there were two pieces. She had a lot of cash that was in the business, retained earnings that she had. And she had been talking to another buyer that had kind of cut her expectations in half, right? She originally thought that she was going to get about 500 grand for it. There was a seller group that told her that they were going to give her somewhere between $150,000 and $250,000. The number that I came up with was $150,000 valuation plus keeping almost all of the retained earnings in the business, which is like, it was like 100 grand basically. Before I sent her the LOI, I got her on a Zoom call and I said, I'm going to walk through this LOI with you and I want to explain it to you. I think had I just sent her the LOI, I knew that it was under
a sticker shock or so.
Yeah, I think it would have been offensive to her. And so I wanted to make sure that it wasn't perceived as like a cash grab offer from me. And so I walked her through it. I said, these are what the issues are going to be. And also additionally, I'm buying into this business because I think that we can scale this as partners together in a massive way. And the last thing I want to do is to cut you the check that takes you off into the sunset. I want you to still be hungry. We had also built a relationship. She was massively excited about the partnership group, me, the other guy, and her doing this business together. So we had spent some time. And so anyway, that's how I backed into the number. I took the number that the other people had kind of mentioned what their range was going to be, but they never put pen to paper on an LOI. And I think it helped that from the very beginning of our relationship, I helped her without expectation of receiving anything because I didn't want to run the business because I didn't feel like I had the skill set to really take it to the next level. So it was just like, here's what I would do. Hopefully that helps. Talk to you later. I think that built a strong foundation from the beginning. And that's happened to me on the sell side before as well, as I've sold escape rooms, trampoline parks. We've turned down better economic offers to go with people that we've had better relationships with.
Because you have to still have some part in the business sometimes. Yeah. So it's like,
I mean, you have to do the
about the purchase price only.
You have to do the transaction itself, which is a long process. You have to be involved, whether it's a seller financing aspect of it. You have to be involved with these people for a fair amount of time. And so being around people that are hard charging or sharks or seem like they'll be litigious or create issues, I think I've always just said life's too short and I'd rather go with somebody that I
like. Yeah. Yeah. So this deal was done without a business broker intermediary, without a ton of transaction fees, accounting fees, lawyer fees. You just got the LOI, you sent it over, walked her through it. What's next? She looks at it, she signs it, she turns it down. What's kind of the next step? How did it go?
There were a couple of days where she was kind of just thinking about it. So I gave her that offer on a Friday. And then on that next Monday, we had another call of like, hey, these are the things that I'm thinking. The price is lower than I expected it to be. We worked through those issues, explained this is the price that I feel like is fair. I know it looks like $150,000 valuation, but it's really not because there's working capital that would typically be left in a business and you're getting an aspect of that. There's more work to do in this business than we originally intended it to be. For her, the big thing was, this was like probably December 11th.
So how long is this deal going? Is this a few weeks, a few months?
I started talking seriously about it like after Thanksgiving. So like first day of December, right? And on December 11th, I think I gave her the LOI. And I said, if we can agree on these terms, if we can get the high level done, we'll close on it before the year's over. It's like a 2-week turnaround in terms of negotiating purchase and sale agreement and figuring out everything on transitioning the business over. I think our ability to move quickly and have her have something done before the end of the year for tax purposes and to just start 2023 knowing what her 2023 is going to look like, I think that was exciting to her. And so she signed it. We started working on the purchase and sale agreement together. Purchase sale agreement and the operating agreement. Those are the two docs since we were staying in this business together. We structured it as an asset sale. So that way we could move all of the assets over to a new entity and start from scratch with new partnerships. After we got it under LOI, I had two buddies that were interested in investing in the business as well. And so I raised a little bit of money from them just because they were interested.
So it didn't necessarily have to be all your money. You could bring in other people to the table even later on in the stage. Okay. Because I think that's a big hesitation for a lot of people, is that they just think that this is not an opportunity for them at all, or acquisition entrepreneurship or searching for a company is not something they can do because they don't necessarily have the money. Would you say that the deal is the most important thing and then you can raise the money, or how do you typically?
I was really surprised at how easy it was to raise the money. I had two conversations with people and I said, this is the deal that I'm doing. I'm going to put my own money in unless you're interested in it. They bought in at basically a $500,000 valuation. I was getting in at a $150,000 valuation, but obviously being the general partner and doing all of the work, me and this other guy, that was what the economics looked like. We raised $100,000 for 20% of the new entity. And the three of us, me, the other guy, and the girl, are the managing members of the entity. So we make all the decisions. The two other people are true limited partners that have voting or can't make any decisions in terms of how the business gets run. And we did the deal that way.
Awesome. And what's the current? So the last part is the signing of the purchase agreement, signing of the operating agreement, decide on that. And then there's an official date of close happens. And then going forward, what's the process like? Like, how is she still running the business? How involved do you have to be? Because you bought a business that requires a special kind of knowledge and certification, but you don't have that. And yet you're still part of the business. So how is that working out today now?
Yeah, we've owned it for 2 weeks, basically. We have one meeting a week right now. You know, my part of the deal was really getting the deal done. I was very active getting the LOIs, the purchase and sale agreements. I was massively involved in that aspect, setting up the entities, new tax IDs, all that stuff. And then the other partner, who's the webinar guy, his process is basically starting now for the next month. It's revamping the webinar. Sales are still happening right now. I posted this today on Twitter. Since we bought it, it's generated about $13,000 in revenue. Of that, $10,000 of profit. But we plan on spending probably $30,000 in a new tech stack, a new webinar process. We'll be spending an additional $5,000 a month that wasn't spent before, and a more systemized social media cadence for her. She's a content machine, so she loves producing content. And so we're trying to invest in her personal brand because it drives so many sales, and just getting her out there more and kind of refining, recrafting the message. And so we plan on, for the next 3 to 4 months, basically all of the free cash flow getting reinvested in the product, the webinar, more professionalized sales process. We've also increased the price by $1,000 per ticket because people will pay it. And we're seeing how conversions are affected, and they haven't been affected at all. I spent a lot of time with her on Zoom calls in person, and I became really comfortable with her judgment, her vision, what she's excited by. I like the fact that she's got a lot of certifications. She's spent a lot of time in school working towards these professional degrees. I got massively comfortable with her, which made it easier to do the deal. If she gets hit by a car tomorrow, the business won't do well. If the business probably had another zero at the end of it, I probably would have a 5-year life insurance policy on her, because if something happens to her in the next couple of months, then that's probably the biggest risk to the business.
You hedge that. How do you plan to kind of grow the company? Is that something that now that's your role? Is that her role? Well, how do you look about the company for the plan for 2023, 2024? And was that part of the buying process? Like back when you and your partner were looking at the P&L and balance sheet, is that something you factored in? Or
within this partnership, my role is basically M&A. And so finding the deal, negotiating the deal, bringing the capital to the table, getting the deal done. And now my role is, depending on the strategic vision, so we have a call in 2 days in terms of what 2023 and 2024 look like. Do we want to build this to sell? What does that look like? Do we just want to build it as a cash machine? And that's a conversation amongst the, I'm one vote of three in terms of what that needs to look like. If the decision is let's build it for the next 2 years and exit it, then I'll be more involved in that process of making it look less like a webinar education style business and more like probably a content style. I'll go on markets and marketplaces and see what are the types of businesses in this medical related field that are selling, what are the multiples, and how can we slowly start pivoting over and over and over to get to a business that looks more like that. If it's a cash flow machine, then that's really a job for her and that other partner, because that's kind of what they do. That's kind of how the breakdown of roles exists. Of I'm M&A deal guy. I've kind of done my part for the very first piece of it. And now I have a little bit of time to let the business get reset, restructured. And in terms of mitigating the risk of something happening to her, it's getting a new webinar out. Her last webinar ran on Evergreen auto webinar for 2 years. I think once we get that new style in and that new webinar done, then there's less risk there, but that's a risk that we are trying to continually minimize over time.
Nice, nice. Okay, great. No, I think that was a great kind of breakdown. So any kind of parting words for any acquisition entrepreneurs, searchers, people looking for their first deal? Anything else you would say for them? How can they go out and replicate this? You do this on a consistent basis. We understand the playbook is comfortable for us. What advice can you give to them to kind of get their first deal under their belt?
Depending on the level that somebody's at, I think a lot of times people feel like they have to run a very specific playbook, whether that's an SBA playbook, a search fund playbook. I look at it like there's no such thing as bad deals, just bad terms. And so if this business would have been unpurchasable to me, if I was like with blinders on of I'm only looking for an SBA deal that is within the trampoline park sector that I can get for 2x cash flow. It took months to figure out the deal scenario that made sense. Obviously, the trite advice is working on deal flow obviously helps as much as possible. You have to find creative ways to get that done. I think the misstep that people make is trying to force themselves. I talk to a lot of people that try to get my advice on whether a potential deal that they're looking at is a good deal or not good deal. A lot of times they'll try to force themselves into the deal because they're so deal hungry. They just want a deal. You have to get yourself to a point where you can be patient enough for the right deal to come along and to take advantage of it. If a deal feels like there's a lot of pressure, and at least for me, the way that I think about it is, a good deal is like a marriage. It's better to be single than to be in a bad marriage. It's better to be on the search than it is to be in a bad deal, because they're difficult to get out of. They're very illiquid and it takes a lot of time to unwind the thing that you're putting yourself into. The advice I give to everyone, and I'll do it till I'm blue in the face, because some of the advice that helped me the most when I was getting started is it has to feel like if you're right, you get rich, and if you're wrong, you don't go broke. And you have to have both of those pieces that are checking. That if it's a deal that, oh, if it goes right, but I don't make that much money, if everything hits perfectly, don't do it. Or I could absolutely crush it. This is like everyone that's ever done anything in crypto ever. I should absolutely crush it. If the tide starts turning the other way, I'll get swept out to sea and I'll lose everything. That's the wrong type of asymmetric bet. It has to be something that if I'm right on this deal, I'll be making at least 200 to 300% a year on the capital that I put in. And that will be a good deal for me. And if I'm absolutely wrong on it, if she dies tomorrow, it doesn't make me homeless. It doesn't end the game for me. And so it was a size that I felt comfortable with. It didn't feel like pressure. I didn't put myself on a treadmill that I felt like was running too fast for me. I've been on those other side where it starts feeling like I have a great white shark on the fishing pole and I'm in a little dinghy. I'm like, this is too big for me, right? This feels scary. And I've learned to pass those off and let those go to somebody else that feels comfortable at the size that they're at. And I've built relationships that way of being less greedy about a deal. This one worked for me and I was patient on it, which isn't my biggest virtue. I think it's right, you get rich, wrong, you don't go broke.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, man. Appreciate your time.